Hi everyone, welcome. So good to see everybody, a lot of familiar names, and just good to get together, especially during the very busy pre-Pesach season. It's always good to get to see everybody, even if it's in this way, not quite in person, but hopefully Beretz Hashem we're getting there. With the weather we're having in Chicago, it feels like maybe going outside and actually seeing people is like soon on the horizon. So we can only hope that it doesn't start snowing next week, but I already know not to hope for that too much. So welcome everyone tonight. Tonight we're here to discuss a very important topic when it comes to Pesach prep. That often when we think about preparing for Pesach, we think about the cleaning and we think about the cooking and we think about all of the logistics that have to go into creating a Chag Kasher V'Sameach, a holiday that will hopefully be kosher and clean and everything will be ready and halachically perfect for Pesach. And we think about like being Sameach a little bit. Like we try to think what will make us the best Yantif. But sometimes preparing for the Seder, which is meant to be the focal point of the holiday, preparing for the Seder kind of gets put on the sidelines. Especially if you are a mom or you are preparing for the holiday in so many other ways, very often the Seder can get put to the side. And then we sit down at the Seder, and we're so excited about the Seder night, and we're ready to be there, a little bit exhausted, but very excited to be there. And we want our kids to be all excited, and we sit down at the Seder, and I'm hungry, I'm tired, when are we eating, do we really have to talk about this again? If it's the second night, forget about it, because you already spoke about it the night before. And now you're like, where's the perfect, the time of discussing Yetzias Mitzrayim and the mitzvah that he got to tell Lebincha? And it seems like it all goes out the window. And we're like, okay, let's just get through Magid and get to eating as fast as we can. So tonight we're here to make sure that that doesn't happen for you. That we're here to discuss how can you best engage your children at the Seder so that you get to that Seder and you're able to truly be involved in that mitzvah that he got to tell Lebincha and create that perfect Seder that you imagined. So tonight's panelists are here. They are probably familiar faces to most of you, as they all previously were part of the YU, I mean, everyone's always part of the YU Torah Mitzion Kollel family, but they previously lived in Chicago and are really expert educators who have experience with students and children in and out of the classroom of all ages, and they're here to share their expertise with us tonight. Let me quickly introduce the panelists, and then we'll get started. If anyone has questions, feel free to write them in the chat, and we will get to them at the end. First panelist is Rabbi Ira Wallach. He is a Rebbe and the Limudei Kodesh coordinator at Hafter High School in Cedarhurst, New York. Prior to working at Hafter, Rabbi Wallach taught Tanakh at the Ramaz Upper School. And before teaching at Ramaz, Rabbi Wallach was a Rebbe at the Ida Crown Jewish Academy in Chicago, Illinois, and he was the boys' mechanich for 2 years. Rabbi Wallach was a founding member. He was in the first year of the YU Torah Mitzion Kollel. He learned in the Kollel for 2 years. Before moving to Chicago, Rabbi Wallach received his smicha from Reitz and his master's in education from Azrieli and his bachelor's from Yeshiva College. We're very excited to welcome Rabbi Wallach back tonight. When I was doing a little research for the program and trying to figure out what year of the Kollel everyone was, just a little fun Chicago like blast from the past, I Googled Rabbi Wallach's name and the original Ida Crown newsletter popped up welcoming the YU Torah Mitzion Kollel to Chicago. And it was very fun to see who had been in that first year of the Kollel. So welcome Rabbi Wallach. Next up, we have Rabbi Eitan Ehrenfeld. Rabbi Ehrenfeld learned in the YU Torah Mitzion Kollel in Chicago from 2011 to 2013. He has his bachelor's and his master's from Yeshiva University, and he is currently a doctoral candidate at YU's Azrieli Graduate School. Rabbi Ehrenfeld received smicha from Reitz. He then learned in the Gross Kollel in Yerushalayim, and after the Kollel, Rabbi Ehrenfeld taught for 4 years at Ida Crown and then served as the assistant rabbi at KCT in Skokie. Rabbi Ehrenfeld and his wife Tamar currently live in West Hempstead, New York. I kind of feel like without having known Rabbi Ehrenfeld, we have followed the exact same path in life. So who knows, maybe we'll move to West Hempstead next. No, don't worry, we'll stay.
Don't worry, you stay in Chicago.
Yeah, we're staying, don't worry. And last but not least is Mrs. Miriam Schwartz. Miriam lives in Bergenfield with her husband, Rabbi Eli Schwartz, and their three-year-old son, Adir, who was born in Skokie. She spent a year studying at Migdal Oz before she attended Stern College for Women, where she was part of the Legacy Heritage Jewish Educators Project. She has a master's in Jewish education from the Azraeli School of Jewish Education and is a candidate for a master's in Bible at the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Judaic Studies and a master's in Biblical and Talmudic Interpretation at GPATS, the YU's Graduate Program for Advanced Talmudic Studies. Miriam has taught Judaic Studies at the Yeshiva of Flatbush High School. That's the one part where I am more like Miriam in this aspect, at the Yeshiva Flatbush and at Ida Crown Jewish Academy, and where she was the co-director of student activities. She has worked as a director and educator at the OU Jewish Learning Initiative on campus at the University of Maryland and the University of Pennsylvania. She is a certified college teacher and enjoys many fun things such as Tai Chi and Pilates. Thank you so much to all of our panelists for joining tonight. So let's jump right in. The first question that I want to ask our panel is, if you can think back, what did your Pesach Seder look like growing up? And how has that impacted what your Seder looks like today? Is it similar? Is it completely the opposite? What are the similarities and what are the differences? Let's start with Rabbi Ehrenfeld for our first question.
Thank you so much. And it's so great to see so many familiar names, familiar faces. Certainly miss everyone in Chicago, and always has a fond place in my heart and Tamar's heart. And we think about you often, and we hope that the day will come soon where we can come visit. So, you know, growing up, I had a very very typical, traditional Seder. Pretty plain, minimal divrei Torah, just kind of moving along in the process. Nothing stood. It was always great. It was always fun. You know, we hid the Afikoman. We followed everything. Everything was good. I don't have any particular things that jumped out, memories that I hold from it. And you know, obviously, sometimes we're still with my parents on Pesach, and it's very different now. The next stage, I would say, is probably my yeshiva days, whether that was when I was in Israel, when I was in Smicha, and that was like the Dvar Torah phase, and there were like lots and lots and lots of Divrei Torah, and the Seder would go late. You know, that was like the time in your life, it was like my Seder was up, I was up till 2 a.m. And more recently, I would say the current iteration is very, very child focused. Thank God we have beautiful little children, ages 4 to 10, and they are not interested in my Divrei Torah, no matter how beautiful and inspirational I might find them, no matter how many Svarim they come from, and that's fine. That's normal. That's age appropriate. And so I've really shifted the entire focus of my Seder onto my children, which is, you know, I believe really what the essence of the Pesach Seder is about, what the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim is about. And so as I'm preparing for the Seder, this time of year, I'm just thinking about what can I do to keep my children engaged? What are the activities I'm going to have planned? What are the questions I'm going to ask them? What are they doing in school? It's primarily about them. I'm not as worried about the Divrei Torah and the fancy Haggadot. It's really focusing on my children. And that's, I would say, been the evolution from when I grew up till today.
Great. Thank you so much. Rabbi Wallach, we'd love to hear, what did your Seder used to look like and what does it look like today?
Sure. So just to echo also just Rabbi Ehrenfeld, it is a blast from the past. I see Mrs. Silverman. I just actually saw a picture of Gali and Tali not too recently at their first sleepover. It's a quick shout out, but it is nice to be virtually back. Okay, so I'll start out this way. So I know that I'm residing in the Five Towns, so please don't judge me for this super Five Townsy comment. But I grew up actually not really having Siddurim at home. My parents would always go away, and it was very beautiful, but it felt very not warm. not making your own, you know, charoses, making sure that your hands were all dry and callous from checking the maror. I did not have that home seder. So I remember I negotiated with my parents my second year in Eretz Yisrael to stay in Israel for Pesach, and several of my friends, we rented an apartment in Har Nof, and that has a whole slew of stories, which is, I've reaped the benefits of those stories for many years, many, many Pesachim. But that was when I had that first taste of being able to have Pesach at home at my Rebbe's house in Har Nof, and I was bit by that bug ever since. So I guess I just had that appreciation of a homegrown Pesach. And specifically, one of my more fonder memories is we always, I think many families do always the Echad Miyodea race, and who could say it as fast without slipping it up. And we did that, but there was a certain inflexibility we always had growing up. We are only doing these songs. It has to be done in this way. And I think that certainly echoing what Rabbi Ehrenfeld said is that if I wanted to be my Seder to be directed towards the kids, by definition, there's got to be flexibility and to sometimes to rethink things and obviously maintain our traditions, because that makes everything that much more richer and that much more enjoyable. But at the same time, to be open to certain flexibility and to incorporate, you know, new things. So if you want to sing, you know, your classic Kilo Noe, Kilo Yoe, and then you could always incorporate something that's more contemporary or whatever, you know, floats the kid's boat and whatever is going to inspire.
Great. Thank you so much. And Miriam, how has your Seder evolved?
So first of all, echoing Rabbi Ehrenfeld's sentiments and Rabbi Wallach's, we miss Skokie and the Chicagoland community and all of you tremendously. And it's so nice to see all of your faces and names for those of you who are camera shy right now. It's really such a pleasure to feel like we were coming home. Ellie was sitting with me while we were talking about the things that we were planning to, that I was planning to say tonight. And he just kept like having the smile on his face. Like, I can't believe you get to virtually go back to Skokie. So he's upstairs in case Adir wakes up, but we're looking forward also to visiting you all in person when it's safe to do so. So like Rabbi Ehrenfeld, I grew up with a very traditional Seder, and in my grandmother's house originally, and then moved to my house when my grandmother and my grandfather got older, and the leader would tell things and say things and everyone would listen. And there was a lot of emphasis on listening and following along and sometimes reading, but really just paying attention. And I think what's unique about my family Seder, and I know that this is the case for some of your families as well, my family is a very diverse family. So my grandparents are conservative. My cousins are Reform and unaffiliated and conservative. There's no other people in my immediate family, like my cousin network, who are Orthodox. So that's my family's job, is to be the Orthodox people. So we also kind of played that role at the Seder, where we were the kind of the source of Torah education. And my dad always saw it as his responsibility to say the best of our Torah, to get everyone engaged so that they could like see the beauty of Judaism and the beauty of Orthodoxy. And so there was always a little bit of an undertone of that. And I always really looked forward to when my dad would really take out his farm to prepare, but the Seder itself was very traditional. I know that the most exciting part for me as a kid was getting to, first of all, say the Manishtana all together. One year my grandmother decided we should all do it together, because I'm the oldest, so I have never, and my youngest brother is a year younger than me. The brother closest in age to me is a year younger than me, so I never actually got the experience of saying the Manishtana until one year it was everyone's doing it together, so that was a lot of fun. But I remember that I always had Divrei Torah. I always would come to the Seder with my notebook that I had prepared in school, and I would like read them, and everyone in my family would wait for me to be done with them. And I'm sure that that's still the experience for some of you. I know that when I speak to educators in schools, the kids always go home with a ton to say. But the focus was never really on the education. The focus was on the food and on the company. Making sure that there was really good food was a priority to my grandmother growing up. There was always delicious meat, and the charoset was a family recipe that was passed down. And there was always a lot of conversation about the food, which I think is still an important part of our Seder. But I'll speak in a second about how we've shifted in priorities. But The food was a really important part of the company, the emphasis on the fact that our family was all coming together, because everyone originally, we used to sleep at my grandmother's house. And then when she got older, so family would drive to our house because they weren't affiliated and weren't halakhically observant. So they would drive, come for the Seder, and we would all be so excited to finally be together. And then they would drive home. And so I remember hearing about my friends whose families slept over on Yantif and how exciting that was. And I never had that. So it was kind of like everyone would leave when they got bored of the Seder. And then at the end, it would be us having that Chagat Yaris that Rabbi Wallach was talking about. And sometimes my grandmother would stick around. But so like Rabbi Wallach, I wanted to stay in Israel during my year in Israel. I had all of these shirim and migdalos preparing for the Seder. I had grown up hearing the Haggadah in English. And so I finally was actually looking at the Hebrew words of the Haggadah and learning about it for the first time. And I was so excited to learn more. And I wanted to really go to my teacher's house for the Seder. And my teacher was Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon, who has written many Halachas Farim and is a tremendous resource in the community for Torah. And he actually has a Haggadah, which I think Emma prepared a question about Haggadah. So we'll talk about his Haggadah in a little bit. But he is just a masterful educator. And he would talk about the experiential things he would do with his family. And I had gone to his family on Rosh Hashanah. So I had seen what he did experientially around that meal with his family. And I was just like dying to go and to spend the Seder with his family. So on the phone with my parents, we're negotiating. I said, I really want to go to Alon Shvut. I want to go to Rav Rimon. I want to go to Esti. They've all invited me. I'm really excited. And my parents were like, you have to come home for the Seder. It's family, the food. Like, we're going to do it. Like, we're going to do the same thing we always do. It's really special. Don't forget about us back home. So I told them finally that I had two conditions, that I would come home, but I would come home if we got better wine, because we had Manischewitz every year until I was in Israel for the year. So if we got better wine, and that we would plan the Seder together, that it wouldn't be my dad last minute scrambling to go through the Haggadahs. And it was always a lot of pressure on him as the leader of the Seder. And I wanted to come home to an exciting experiential Seder. And I was excited to do that with my family. So I said, I'm not going to plan it because I'm not the leader of the Seder, but I want us to try to plan it together, if that's not too much to ask. And my parents said yes. So I went wine shopping with my parents and we planned a Seder. And we made a Google Doc that year. I still remember so fondly because my family still talks about it as an incredible experience. We made a Google Doc of all of the parts of the Seder. And my mom, I was like, I'm not calling my aunt and my grandma and asking them to prepare for the Seder. What does that mean? But so we decided that every adult that was coming to the Seder should have something to prepare. And so we divided up the entire Seder. And so everyone prepared something. And we decided in the end, the kids should also prepare something. And I have such fond memories from that year, similar to Rabbi Wallach, when we embraced being flexible, we were able to take the pressure off. Like, I remember our family belting out, go down Moses at the top of our lungs. And my grandfather saying the Manishtana in Klingon, and everyone just brought something to the Seder that they felt good about, and it really took the pressure off. So from then on, my siblings and I really take the lead on the educational part of the Seder. And right now, the interesting thing, the different thing about our Seder is that Adir's three, he'll be asleep before the Seder, I hope, because otherwise he'll be a monster the next day. So our Seder is mostly college students. Like the youngest people at our Seder, well, this year, well, it'll just be probably our immediate family again because of COVID, but we're speaking more globally about Seders in general. Our Seder, the youngest person at our Seder at this point, is a college student. And so the conversation has gotten very deep and very educationally focused, but in a way that wasn't able to be possible when the focus was on this like frontal, we're going to do the Seder as like a checking the boxes experience. And once every adult in the family really started to own what it meant to have a Seder together, it became an experience that everybody looks forward to every year, to the point that we had a nice family call recently because my brother is about to finish the Israeli army. And so we had a call with the whole family together to kind of say mazel tov to him. And my cousins who quit Hebrew school before their bar and bat mitzvahs were saying how sad they were to not have a Seder this year, which is just really special to me. So looking forward to having that again.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And that is going to lead us right into our next question. And that is, often, as Miriam expressed, Seders are not made up of all people who are exactly the same age and exactly the same level of observance, and even of all people that learn in the same way. So our next question is actually combining two of the questions, but how do you approach dealing with diversity at your Seder? Whether that means people who are different ages, whether that means people who are different levels of observance, or whether that means people who learn in different ways. So if you have a child who is really a very visual learner, how do you suggest dealing with that at a Seder? That you make your Seder engaging to everyone who's present. And let's start, Miriam, if you lead us right back into the next question.
Sure. I'm just combining the notes that I have here on the two sections. So in education, we talk a lot about differentiated instruction and how the core of good education is that the same thing is not going to work for everyone. And so one of the things that we noticed is that the Seder is kind of built for extroverts, those people that are going to be the loudest people at the table, the people that are going to talk over everybody else, the people that are going to be quick to share an idea or ask a question. And so one of the things that we did that first year was say we needed to build a space for introverts at the table. My brother actually said that he wasn't comfortable sharing in front of the entire group of people that was at the Seder because it was a big crowd, but he'd be so happy to learn a little bit and talk in smaller groups of people. So that year we actually did breakout rooms of our own at our Seder. It was like 10 years ago already at this point, but and we've been doing versions of this ever since where we break up into small groups to do parts of Magid, so that way extroverts get that small group feel, which is something that's a little bit different. Something else that we do is to make sure, and so back to what I was saying before about like the adults all taking ownership of it. So the essence of the Seder really is Vehigata Bencha, of this idea of education and everyone becoming an educator as the essence of the Seder. So at the night of the Seder, everybody steps into that role, not just the people that have educational experience, not just the people that know a lot of Torah. And there's a statement that came to mind when I was thinking about the notion of having everybody become an educator, that the Lubavitcher Rebbe would tell his followers, if you know Aleph, teach Aleph. You don't have to know Kol HaTorah Kula. You don't have to know the entire Torah. You don't have to know the entire Haggadah. You don't have to know everything about the story and Chumash, Rashi, everything in order to teach something. And so if everyone takes ownership of the fact that it's all of our responsibility to be educators on that night, then the experience is so significantly uplifted. And so back to what I was saying before, we had a spreadsheet that everyone took ownership of it. And what I loved is seeing the way that different adults owned it in ways that were comfortable to them. So some people prepared games. My grandfather prepared Manishtana in Klingon. Other people prepared like a poem, a poster. My aunt actually, we gave her, I think Avadim Hayinu was her part, and my parents just moved, so we just threw them out, but we were very sad to throw them out. She made these like shackles out of paper, and she had us all walk around with these like paper chain shackles. And this is my aunt, who doesn't have educational experience, who is conservative, is involved in a conservative shul, and here she is becoming a masterful educator of experiential learning about the Seder because we gave her ownership of that. And we said, hey, we want you to be involved in teaching your children because the responsibility is for you to become a teacher on that night. So everyone taking ownership and having a role is key to our Seder. The other thing is that we all use the same Haggadah. This is something I know that my husband's family, they use different Haggadahs and it works for them because they're all in an intellectual place where they're able to kind of bounce back and forth, but just to accommodate the people that can't follow along on their own, we always want to make sure that we can be inclusive and to say, hey, we're on page number 57 if you're lost, and for whoever's responsibility is to kind of guide the Seder along in that way. I mean, my dad still has the role of the leader of the Seder, but the leadership role is a little bit dispersed, which helps in that way, but he still tells everyone what page that we're on. So we all use the same Haggadah, and everyone could opt to read Hebrew or English. Like I said before, God speaks English. I really value learning the Haggadah in Hebrew and the story because of my experience with Rabbi Rimon, but not everybody that's not accessible to everybody. And so for me, it's very important, and for my family, to make the Seder accessible. But we also do have other Haggadahs present, so everyone could pick a Haggadah and share ideas from different places. So we've been kind of mixing that up recently. For younger kids, I'm thinking back to when my cousins were younger in that first year. So one of the things that we decided, because Emma mentioned before, everyone getting super cranky and hungry by then, like hangry is a real thing that happens at the Seder. And hangry is also a real thing that happens with adults who drink 2 cups of wine before they have any meals. So what we did at our first Seder is basically create a karpas course. I know that there's conversations about how much karpas you can or should eat. So I personally eat my one piece of karpas. karpas, but we make an entire buffet of vegetables and things that could be karpas. So anybody that's starving at the beginning of the seder will just subconsciously like start to snack on carrots and like parsley and whatever other, I think we put out radishes also. That's one of the things that we used in our family, and to have vegetables available so that it's basically a salad course. So that way you overcome that hangry part. And then the last piece that has really made our seder a pressure-free experience is that we have pillows everywhere and a blanket rule that you can go to sleep or take a cat nap at any time without judgment. And that's been a key to including everyone from young to old in the seder, because when there's so much pressure to stay awake and be there until 2 o'clock in the morning and to be a part of everything and to be focused, then people aren't enjoying it because there's this pressure of what can and should be. And everyone feels like the seder should be a certain thing and I should be a part of this. And when we take should out of the question and give everyone permission, if you're tired, if you want to take 15 minutes, tell someone to come wake you up in 15 minutes. If you're so tired you just can't anymore, we'll save you a piece of the afikoman for the morning. Go for it. Go to sleep. And so in previous years, my cousins have actually started sleeping over because at some point everyone leaves and like the couch is full of all of my cousins and my grandmother and everyone's just like sleeping in places. And I feel like there's something so sedery about that, of having everyone in one place and it becomes kind of like a big sleepover. But the nice thing is that like there's no shame about not being able to do the full seder. And so what we noticed is that in recent years, because there's no pressure to stay, people were staying later and longer and people were more excited about it because they no longer had to do it, but they were excited about it. So those are just a few thoughts that I had about including diversity of people and differentiating and making the seder a little bit more inclusive. And I'm looking forward to hearing what Rabbi Ehrenfeld and Rabbi Wallach have to say about including young kids, because we're almost at that stage and I'm very excited for it.
Thank you. I am taking notes here. I'm very excited about all these new ideas for the seder. This is great. Rabbi Wallach, you're up next.
Okay, a lot to follow. I'm going to, I guess, listen, we only can work based off of our own personal experience. So right now, my oldest is 15 and we have Baruch Hashem all the way down to a year and change. So for my family, so we do actually have a wide variety of ages, and we also have a wide variety of sort of different personalities. So we've done in the past, you know, we've dressed up, we've done Family Feud where we've taken, top five Pesach dishes that you like just to keep everyone interested and engaged. So two things that we have found to be very successful to respond to the different ages, and a particular activity that responds to the different personalities, is one is the kids work really, really hard, as Mrs. Schwartz had mentioned, to prepare for the Leil HaSeder, you know, bringing their, you know, their 500-page Haggadah from school. Now, the problem, and it's wonderful, and kids by definition are very, you know, they're very egocentric. It's all about them, and it should be all about them. And they work so hard, and they want to share everything that they have. But what ends up happening is two things. One is that even though they may have learned it, when they, you know, they read it at the Seder table, it's not, you know, it's not fluid. They have to practice it. They bumble over it. And also there's just sometimes too much. So one rule that we have in the Wallach house is that not just we, you know, the parents have to prepare for the Seder, but the kids have to prepare for the Seder also, like Mrs. Schwartz mentioned. So we make a rule that each kid must, but not more than three of their Divrei Torah. And they need to practice it on Erev Pesach. They need to practice, or whatever, or beforehand. So that way, each kid no one will be overwhelmed by all the Divrei Torah that everyone's going to share, but they will be able to say it clearly and coherently. So that's one thing that we do that I found which is very beneficial. And obviously, again, they'll do six of their Divrei Torah over the two Yamim Tovim and Chutz La'aretz. The second thing, so that I found that works, at least again with my crowd, and does bridge all the different learners, is stories. You know, I tried doing other years, you know, doing themes and putting like different posters on my walls and for kids to guess what the theme is. What I found is the ultimate nullifier. Again, for my group,
is stories. And whatever stories work for you, you know, there are some wonderful books. You know, Rabbi Spiro has a Touched by a Story Haggadah. I personally do better with, you know, historical and or, you know, a lot of Israeli stories that really connect me in personal stories. So I always try to get a long-winded story that really grabs the kids' attention. And that for the most part, really works and does bridge the gap. Again, and when there's time in between the meal, my brother-in-law and I, we speak in learning. We speak about more, you know, in-depth discussions. And I'm sure as my kids get older, and we already have, we do get my daughter who's in high school, who's very learned and very impressive. We have our discussions, but when, you know, having the group all learning together, that I always think, again, for our group is the silver bullet.
Great. Thank you so much. And Rabbi Ehrenfeld.
Wow. A lot to think about and a lot to follow. I certainly will agree and reiterate Rabbi Wallach's point about stories. I think stories are something that resonate with all ages and all backgrounds. Everyone loves a good story. And some of you may know this about me. Stories is actually something that's not in my comfort zone. I'm much more comfortable discussing a contradiction in the Rambam or a problematic Gemara or a philosophical question. Stories are actually far out of my comfort zone, but I've been pushing myself more and more because, you know, believe it or not, my 7-year-old daughter isn't as interested in the contradiction in the Rambam as I am. So I've been pushing myself. Last year, actually, they put out, I'll just throw out one recommendation, Rabbi Pesach Kron, all the Maggid books, they put out a Haggadah, he put out a Haggadah, I think it's called the Maggid at the Seder. I have it at school or else I'd show it to you, but it's you know, filled with beautiful stories. So I found that stories are something that really resonates across all ages. Something else that I'm trying this year is puzzles. I've always loved puzzles as a kid, brain teasers, whatever kind of puzzles there are. So I did a little searching online and I came across an escape the room Pesach style or escape from Mitzrayim, whatever you want to call it. And it was really cool. It was 5 puzzles geared for I would say younger kids, probably in the 5 to 12 range. It's a little bit of work. You got to like order stuff, but basically it's for hiding the Afikoman. You take that Afikoman, you're putting it in a box. You're putting 5 different locks on that box, 5 different puzzles. You can give them out to all the kids till each kid gets one. You can only get the Afikoman if you crack all 5 codes. You can find the one online. If anyone is curious, I'm happy to send you the link for it. I don't take any credit. I didn't make it up. I just found it. Or you can make your own. But something like that, I think puzzles are a way, they're just a great way to engage people. I think, again, of all ages. So that's, and lastly, I'll just, talking about different learning styles, because obviously as an educator, it's something I do spend a fair amount of time thinking about. And I believe I once heard Rav Rimon in Chicago talk about how he believed that Maggid was actually constructed to appeal to different learning styles. And you know, you have more auditory pieces, you have kinesthetic pieces where you're holding things, you pick up the coast, you pick up the Seder plate, you know, matzah zoo, you hold the matzah. And I do think that it's something to really think about. And if you do feel like you have a sense of a particular learning style, you should absolutely lean into that hard. I don't mean necessarily your learning style, but also your child's learning style. Definitely lean into that hard. You have people that are auditory learners, and for them, just hearing the conversation might be the way that they're going to process it. The songs might resonate with them. You have people that are visual learners. There are so many beautiful Haggadot that are out there. That have just beautiful drawings that engage people in different ways. Many of them they incorporate different midrashim into the pictures, And, you know, instead of saying, here's a text, let's read what this Midrash says or Rashi says. Let's look at this picture. What can we find? Oh, yeah, I remember hearing that about the Makot or that about Kriyat Yamsuf. So that's a beautiful way and a wonderful way to engage a visual learner, kinesthetic learners, people that need to hold things, people that need a touch, especially a lot of younger kids. They really engage that way. Lean into that. It shouldn't, you know, when you do Pesach Matzah Maror, talk about the matzah. What does it feel like? What does it taste like? You know, like really embrace that aspect of the learning style. And I think that you will, you'll really find a high level of engagement. I'll just end with one more point, just because, you know, Rabbi Wallach mentioned that kids are often coming home with reams and reams of materials, which is beautiful. As someone who works in a school, I think it's beautiful, but I certainly understand the difficulty in managing it. I would also recommend embrace the whole 8 days. You know, we don't have to limit ourselves to the two siddurim. That should be a focal point. But you know, if your child comes home with dozens and dozens of divrei Torah, and you certainly just can't manage that at a seder, you know, or things they want to share, you have lunch. The Sudat Yom Tov is a beautiful time to share, or dinners at Chol HaMoed, or the second days of Yom Tov. You know, there are other opportunities, and don't shortchange your children. Again, you don't want to, it's sometimes not possible to give every child every opportunity. You know, you can't have 15 Divrei Torah about Manishtana, or you're never going to get to, you know, you're just never going to get to Avadim Hayinu. But definitely embrace the whole 8 days of Pesach. There's no reason to say, well, second Seder is done, we don't need that anymore. I definitely would encourage families to do that as well. Something we try and do with our children at home.
Thank you so much. I definitely can appreciate that, spreading it out. I remember my parents used to be like, just don't worry, there's always another meal you can say it at. So I appreciated that. And now for our next question, which is, the focus of the Pesach Seder is discussing a story that happened thousands of years ago. How do you suggest we make this, this may be a question that's more focused on older children, but how do we make this a story that's relevant to children, teens, young adults today, that they feel like they can connect to this crazy story of plagues and splitting seas? Rabbi Wallach, let's start with you.
So this actually is, I think, a really good opportunity to bridge the gap, and this can be done on multiple levels, and it's not such a deep chachma, but to approach each child or each individual and ask them to cite an example of where they felt that moment of extreme worry, extreme concern, and when they felt that sense of relief or that sense of, you know, of salvation. And obviously this is a great opportunity for the kids that are younger to personalize and think about the notion of, you know, of chirus, of freedom, of personal freedom on a personal level. And obviously for the older kid, but then you have the ability to then contrast and to highlight particular elements. So, you know, so obviously if you talk about someone who felt that they were, I don't mean to say such trivial, but that's our lives, Baruch Hashem, don't have as such significant moments. But if a kid were to say that I recall that I thought that I was going to have a big test today, but in the end, the teacher, you know, gave us a free period and it was a treat. So you could highlight the fact that, well, there was this idea of an absence on a more sophisticated level. You know, there was an absence of a threat, and then there was also joy. Or if someone were to say that, you know, that I was concerned that, you know, that I may have hurt myself in the end, I didn't. So then you could identify the idea of, you know, of personal and physical salvation. So that does, again, two things. So on the one hand, obviously it personalizes it and causes the child or the person to think about themselves and to be able to put in their shoes. But also you're able to highlight the distinction with there's different types of freedom. There's different types of chiru, there's different types of personalization.
And which is exactly what we see with respect to Yetzias Mitzrayim, that when we talk about the idea of the four languages of Geula, like Rashi mentions in Pesachim based on the Yerushalmi, that those different elements of salvation represent a different element of redemption that we all receive. So you're able to talk about each one, their own personal liberation, and at the same time, identify what exactly is it about that makes it so joyous.
Well, thank you. And Rabbi Ehrenfeld, what are your thoughts?
I think that it's a great question, because I think that's the, I guess that's the challenge of the Pesach Seder, is making it relevant. You know, I think certainly, you know, the idea of plagues, I'm sure we all had that moment sitting at our Seder last year thinking like, wow, we're, you know, we're actually living through one right now. And that was an interesting moment. But I think drawing connections, and really, you know, I'm just building on what Rabbi Wallach said, but drawing those connections, there's an interesting bit of research, and I'm sure this, you may have heard this in another shir, or may have read it somewhere. It was an article published a number of years ago in the New York Times, and it's since certainly become a popular thing to be quoted. It's research by a professor named Marshall Duke, and he found that resilience in children was connected to how well they knew their story, their family's story, their personal history. Did they know where their parents grew up? Did they know how their parents met? And it was fascinating. I believe some of his research was done post 9/11 to see the resilience in children. But in general, he's done a lot of this. He's certainly done a lot of research on this. And what he found, and this is the most interesting part, meaning that's interesting in and of itself, and there's a lesson there that, you know, using the night of the Seder, we're telling our national history, but that can extend into our personal history. And we bring that into the Seder in many ways. Maybe we bring that into the Seder through personal minhagim that we have. Oh, your grandfather used to do this at the Seder. Your great-grandfather used to do this at the Seder. Or maybe there's family recipes for charoset, or, you know, family heirlooms that we use as the Koshel Eliyahu, you know, all sorts of ways. But the most interesting part of the research was actually that Duke found that there were three types of family stories. And it really, the one type was the ascending story. You know, our family came from nothing, and we came here and we worked hard and we built ourselves up. And the other type was the descending story. You know, back in the old country, we were noblemen, we were princes, we were wealthy, and then we came and we've lost everything. And those two, again, were effective in building resilience. But the most effective story in building resilience was what Duke calls the oscillating story, the up and down. Things were so great, but then we lost everything. But then we built ourselves back up, but then your grandfather got sick. And that, you know, that's that up and down. And I think that up and down is the Jewish story. That up and down is the story of the Pesach Seder. And I think, you know, it's been the story of the Jewish people for the last 3,000 years. And I think the night of Pesach is the opportunity to, you know, Yetziat Mitzrayim is to a degree the starting point, although, you know, again, we start in the beginning, you know, mitkila ovdei avodah zarah. We start down, we go up. We go down, we go up. The Haggadah is the starting point, but it doesn't have to be the end point. The end point can be wherever you want it to be. The end point of the story can be wherever you want it to be. And I think using it as an opportunity, using the Seder as a vehicle to convey that story is very, very powerful. Again, it's going to vary by the age of the people you're speaking to and the people you're trying to convey to. The message for, you know, for a 5-year-old is different than the message for a 15-year-old is different than a college-age student. So you have to adapt that accordingly. But I do think that there is tremendous, tremendous power in using the Seder to share your family story.
Wow. I've definitely heard that study quoted, but it's so interesting to think about it in relation to the Seder. And I really like that idea. And Miriam, what are your thoughts? How do we make this a relevant story?
Wow. That's a lot of beautiful. I'm taking notes because that was beyond beautiful, both of you. When I was thinking about this question, I thought right away about what the Maharal says in his Shabbos HaGadol Drasha. That is that we have this mitzvah to prepare for every single chag, shloshim yom kodam lachag, 30 days before chag, but at a very minimum, because of the context of that mitzvah, which appears in the conversation about Pesach Sheni, at the very minimum, says the Maharal, it applies to Pesach. And the reason for that is because Pesach is an avoda, and the avoda is really, really hard. And I think letting that sink in for a second, that it's very hard to do this work of Seder. It's very hard to connect to ancient history that feels like it was so long ago. I know that at the beginning of my Seder growing up, my grandmother would always say, Avadim Hayinu, what do you mean? We weren't slaves. I wasn't there. And so there is that feeling deep down, I wasn't there. This isn't my story. It's my national history. It's my family's story, but maybe it wasn't me. And so I think there's really two aspects, and there's many aspects, but I want to focus on two to being successful in tapping into what that means, to actually connect to Avadim Hayinu and to really feel that. So the first is tapping into personal pain and redemption, and the second is actually working hard to tap into that ancient Egypt story, which I think is, for a lot of us, a lot harder. So the first one, Rabbi Wallach and Ehrenfeld shared a lot of amazing ideas about tapping into the personal story of pain and redemption, and I know that Rabbi Brand shared with us on our tour of the Holocaust Museum my first year in the Kollel, the bracha that was said in a concentration camp for eating chametz on Pesach, and that's something that we always read every single year at our Seder. That's a powerful and impactful relic of what it meant to observe Pesach in Jewish history and what it meant to have pain and not access to food and not access to mitzvot and to be really oppressed in recent memory. We also share a lot of personal family stories, and that oscillating narrative is something that we're constantly working on, because I think the instinct is to kind of present it as that ascending narrative, like Rabbi Ehrenfeld was saying before, like everything was terrible and now it's good, which is the way the Haggadah is structured. So it's a little bit of a push and pull between the two. And I think that also thinking about last year during coronavirus, when we were talking about the plagues and about like just what it means to be oppressed and to be looking for redemption. I know that last year when I said Lashana Haba Yerushalayim Habanuya, I davened for Mashiach in a very different way. I don't know about any of you, because I was just waiting for this. We didn't know when it was going to end, and you can deal with anything if you know that it's going to end, but we didn't know when it was going to end, and we still don't know when it's going to end. And that feeling of shibud, like feeling the oppression for the first time, was very impactful for me, and I started to understand for the first time why it is that so many people share Holocaust stories at the Seder, because that, like, it's easy to relate to oppression when it's your family's oppression and your own experience. And so I think that our experience of the pandemic is actually going to be a very useful tool in the future moving forward when it comes to framing the Seder and having our children and our children's children relate to what it means to really suffer and to have your entire religious observance turned on its head. I really think that we're going to be, it's not the same as the Holocaust. It's a different kind of oppression. But I think that because it's our own lived experience, it's actually, once we're out of the weeds of it, it's going to be a very powerful educational tool. But then there's also the feeling like we actually left Egypt, which is much, much harder to do, says the Maharal. And I remember 3 years ago sitting with my mom on the floor and actually cutting out fabric sheets, because we had decided that everyone was going to be Egyptians that year. And so this is like one cute way that you could all actually try to embody what it means to be a slave. Like, we put on those, like, we all wore robes and we put on like fabric on our heads with a headband, so we looked like those stereotypical desert Bedouin and people. And that was powerful because we all look different. And so there was this moment of like, we're actually reenacting the story. And we actually, when we were talking about the Haggadah, and we've tried to do it every year since, but 3 years ago for the first time, when we were going through the Haggadah, instead of saying they, we changed the language to I and we. And changing our language, there's so much power in language. And so to actually speak about it as when I was in Egypt and when Moshe came to me and when I saw this plague happen, and to be able to have that first person narrative conversation about the Haggadah really helped us imagine, and helped me personally imagine, that I was there. Persian culture. So I grew up in Great Neck, which is a Persian community, which is why whenever anyone hears that I'm from Great Neck, they ask me if I'm Persian. I'm not. But I grew up going to these schools with other Persian students and hearing about their traditions and Sephardic culture. I did a little bit of research into this before this night. And Sephardic culture is so full of experiential moments to put ourselves back in that space of had we been in Egypt and feeling what that's like. So for example, during Avadim Hayinu, they actually all walk around and smack each other with leeks so that they should all actually feel what it was like to be beat by a taskmaster. And when it comes to I'm forgetting which part it is, but they would like, there's one part where the leader of the Seder puts the matzah on his back and walks around and everyone, there's like a script, kind of like when at Pidyon HaBenz, we have a script that's like an Aramaic thing. So they have a Persian script that they read through, but everyone understands it or they translate it. And it's the script that's like, where are you going? I'm going to Israel. Where are you coming from? I'm coming from Egypt. I was a slave. And the person really owns the narrative. And so I think to kind of have not necessarily that same exact skit, but to create moments to have a narrative of people being able to put their own like slave experience in first person is very, very powerful. And then another tool that I think the Seder really lends itself to, especially for older students, which is kind of my area of focus, high school and college students, is to use the slavery in Egypt, especially because I've taught Sefer Shemot. And so hearing students talk about like what's happening in Sefer Shemot as Moshe is coming to tell the Jewish people that they're going to be freed and they're not down and they don't want to leave Egypt. And then Paro is upset and not letting the Jewish people go. And Moshe comes back and says, Paro's going to let you go eventually. And they're rolling their eyes at Moshe and saying, get out, you're making things worse for us. So during Magid, to really have the opportunity to use that as a theological opportunity for conversations about what would you have done if you were in Egypt? Do you think you would have been among the people who left with Moshe, or would you have stayed in Egypt? That's a really hard conversation to have, but it's an important conversation to have because we all like to think of ourselves as the kind of people who obviously would have believed in Moshe and left Egypt and gone along with everything that was happening. But how many of us would have been part of the era of Rav, who were scoffers, who weren't down and who weren't believing that Moshe was going to take us out? How many of us would have been shaking in our boots during the plagues? We look at the story and we think of God's might. Would we have really felt God's might when the plagues were happening, or would we have been scared out of our minds? And to really take the Seder and to take that story and to imagine that we're living it and we don't know the end. And I think to this effect, the pandemic right now is very useful because we don't know how it's going to end. We're in it. And so imagine yourself in the Seder, in Magid, in the Jewish people in Egypt. Imagine yourself sleeping in the fields. Imagine all of that and do your very best to get your family in that conversation with you. I think if you can get your family on board with the first person thing for older children, it's very powerful. I know it's been impactful and powerful for me. But see what happens and see what they say, because it's a very deep insight into people's soul. I know that like for me, when I was thinking about it for the first time, I wasn't sure that I would have left with Moshe. I wasn't 100% positive that I would have been able to overcome my physical exhaustion to go and to prepare timbrels to go and dance on the other side of the sea. What does that even mean? And so when you're able to see yourself in that position, it lets you see the story of Pesach a little bit differently.
Wow, thank you so much. That was also really, really great. I'm sorry, that's just my reaction. These are just such amazing ideas, really, from everybody. I'm learning so much. This is really a pleasure. And for our final, it's a two-part question. First, what is your favorite Haggadah? What is a Haggadah you suggest for a family Seder or your own personal favorite Haggadah? And the second part of the question is, okay, now if we know the favorite Haggadah and we have all these tips and tricks, like what should we be doing right now? Like what is your preparation schedule for leading up to Pesach spiritually and getting ready for the Seder? What does that look like? So let's start with Rabbi Ehrenfeld.
Okay. So you may notice I have a lot of Sfarim, and I certainly have a lot of Haggadot. I have, let's see if I can, give me one second. So that shelf up there, that's like basically all Haggadahs, that top shelf. My son was curious how many, so we counted recently, and we're in like the 85 Haggadah range. So I'm working on not buying one this year. That's my commitment for the year.
Rabbi Aaron, what's the under over on that one?
I don't like the odds. I'll be honest. I don't like the odds. It's hard to pick one. A lot of things have to do with kind of where you are in where your interests are. What's going to interest me intellectually might be very different from what I want to use at the Seder. So, you know, I may be using a Haggadah right now that's going to be really interesting for me intellectually for my own preparation, but not necessarily something that I'm going to be sharing with others at the Seder. I'll put two out there just because I think that they're really great. I see Tammy Miller here on the Zoom. Hi, Tammy. So I still remember probably meeting you in the Sfarim store, like it must be at least 10 years ago, and you were looking for a Haggadah, and I said, you know, I just got the Rabbi Sachs Haggadah, and it was so good, right? I'm remembering this story, right? And there was like one left. It was before. Now they reprinted it, so it's readily available. But the Rabbi Jonathan Sachs Haggadah is phenomenal. It's accessible. I'm a big fan because it has two parts. It's a Haggadah with, you know, a running commentary that are shorter pieces. And on the other side, he has like essays that range from like 3 to 5 pages. They're not particularly long, but almost like a little bit of like a deeper dive into some different parts of the Haggadah and different parts of the Pesach Seder. So if you're a fan of Rabbi Sachs, and you know, who couldn't be, certainly I would highly, highly recommend his Haggadah. Another one that I have really, really enjoyed, and it's actually also built in a similar way, in the sense that it's from one side a running commentary on the Haggadah, and the other side it's essays, is a Haggadah by Erica Brown. Erica Brown is a scholar somewhere in the Washington, D.C. area. I know, Miriam, you have some connections with her. She's also a prolific author. So her Haggadah, I'm trying to remember the name of it. I just brought all my Haggadot, many of them, to school to share with students. Erica Brown's Haggadah, I'll look it up. Someone's holding it up. Wait, I see it. Seder Talk. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Wallach. So, you know, she's also wonderful. She actually organizes her commentary in different, like, she has different, like, icons to indicate, like, you know, is this, like, a thoughtful question? Is this a story? Is this? So I find it very user-friendly, and I do think that I would definitely recommend hers also, especially, you know, I think it's, you know, she really brings a lot to the table. Her essays are a little longer, If I remember correctly, they're not like the 3 to 5 page range. They are a little longer. In terms of a kid's Haggadah, if you're into that like puzzle kind of thing, I know you asked for one. I'm sorry that I'm sharing too many. Let me right here. So I found two that I've been enjoying with my kids. This one just came out last year, and I'm pretty sure I saw someone. Saw it pop up in the chat. It's called the Passover Haggadah graphic novel. So it's kind of cool. They took the Haggadah. It's literally the words of the Haggadah, and it's just a graphic novel, meaning all the words are just the translation. It also has the traditional text. Really cool. Some really interesting images for discussion. The Makot, you know, Dayenu, like really interesting things. My favorite picture in the whole book is they have a selfie at Kriyat Yamsuf. Like literally, what would it look like if someone took a selfie with Jews from like throughout the ages? So this has been fun. And if you're into like puzzles, this is really a weird one. It's called the Emoji Haggadah. The entire Haggadah in emojis. And you kind of have to like figure out like, what is this even saying? Really fun, really challenging. They have the Haggadah in the back, but if that's something that, you know, is kind of like where your kids are, or you're into that kind of puzzle, it definitely is fun. So that's called the Emoji Haggadah. Kind of hard to like use at the Seder, but if you're going for that puzzle thing, and you want to kind of, you know, say, okay, I'm going to make some photocopies and say, everyone has five, figure out what part of the Haggadah you have. And,
so a couple of things just to get to this farm round. So Mrs. Schwartz spoke about Ramon, so I'm sure she's going to say it also, but I'm also a huge Rabbi Ramon Chassid, and I think his Haggadah is one of the best Haggadahs I've ever read in my life. He's a master educator, actually referenced, and that actually comes out in the style of his Haggadah. And he just, of all the Haggadahs, he just has a wonderful commentary and Maggid and the structure. But Ms. Schwartz, I'm sure you'll talk about it. You could talk more. That's off the cuff.
Say more. That's fine. I see my time.
No, you see your time. Okay. Good. It's a wonderful committee that we're on. So this is it's called Be'er Chaim, Rav Melech Biederman. He is of more of the Hasidish ilk, but he has just these wonderful, very wonderful stories. I'm not sure if it's in English. Rabbi Ehrenfeld can say if it's English. I'm not sure if it's in English yet.
I don't think it is, but I have it sitting right next to me also.
Okay, so, yeah, just
wonderful. Three minds think alike.
Yeah, wonderful, really wonderful, great stories. That's what I very often use in Rav Rimon. Now getting in the kids area, so Gadi Pollack. Gadi Pollack is an incredible Jewish artist. We probably, many of us know as kids, like his book, like The Guy the Tannic, the Lamites Malachos book. So he has a wonderful Haggadah that I'm sure Rabbi Ehrenfeld's about to pull off the shelf. That also is, beat you to it. So that also is just extraordinarily, just really wonderful graph, really wonderful pictures. And for the kids to look at in the middle of the Seder, it's really very powerful. I like that. He also, I got this when it was in Hebrew. But I actually just saw recently that it's also in English. It's so creative. So Gadi Pollack wrote this. It's a yoman. It's a daily diary. It was called Lech Tich Acharai Bamidbar. It basically has this sort of fictitious character named Piduel, and he writes a diary. He was born a little bit after Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and just incredible graphics, just goes through pictures, just goes through the story on a daily basis of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and just really can very much connect to it. I like it very much. And he also, I don't get any money from Gadi Pollack, but he also, again, also has just another one that's also really beautiful, From Darkness to Light, just for the kids to look at. I'm a very big fan. How do I prepare now? I really wish I could say that I prepare now for Leil HaSeder. Right now, I'm just trying to make sure that I am doing shopping and getting as much of the house clean when I do have time to do with my wife. I generally, maybe a couple days before the Leil HaSeder, I try to look up some stories. I try to look up some time. I try to hide out in my car just a little bit, just to stop and think for myself and think about some, maybe a different angle to take that year. And like everyone, I very often, I look at my WhatsApp groups that I'm affiliated with. If anything that sort of, that I find interesting, if there's a particular, but again, like life, I always make sure that I live it with my eyes wide open and see what comes my way. But anything more than that, no, right now I'm just trying to survive going to Muncie last Sunday with my wife to go shopping, but nothing yet as of now to prepare.
Wow, it's great.
I cede my time.
I was thinking as you're speaking that this is another Zoom perk, that how often do we get a tour of the speaker's personal bookshelf as they're speaking? So welcome to everybody's living rooms.
Yes.
And last but not least, Miriam, what is your favorite Haggadah and how are you beginning to prepare for the Seder?
So first of all, in Eretz Hashem, we're going to be moving in a week and a half or 2 weeks into our new house that we just bought in Bergenfield. So our Sfarim will meet us then. And so you're all invited for a personal tour of our bookshelves once we set them up. I feel a little bit like I need my Sfarim with me now more than ever. I miss them every day, but right now I miss them especially. So something similar to Rabbi Ehrenfeld is that my husband, since he was in Israel for the year, has bought a new Haggadah every single year. And so we alternate. He gets to pick one year. I get to pick one year. This is his year. So I'll let you know what he decides. I don't know yet.
but one Haggadah, so the Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon Haggadah is a really, really special Haggadah. He has a couple of editions, and this is part of the masterful educator-ness that is Rabbi Rimon, is that he has a Haggadah that's more of a traditional commentary on the Haggadah because he's a prolific thinker and learner and teacher of Torah. And then he has the family Haggadah, which is full of, really, the goal of the family Haggadah is differentiated instruction within the Haggadah, where there's facts and there's riddles and there's, I don't know if any of you have ever seen a book by Rabbi Rimon, only recently they've been translated into English, but he has like little instructions on the sidebar. It really changes the game on what a Sefer canon should look like in terms of being engaging. He has like bubbles of, if this person would enjoy this, then read this and read this at this point, or skip this if this is something that's not going to sit well. So he has riddles and facts and stories and like things in the margins that are, is the Seder educator, the leader of the Seder, or the adults that are involved dream. You don't have to have your kids have it, but to be able to be armed with those stories, because he really did the research for you. He created a model to lead a Seder that's engaging and that's exciting. My personal favorite Haggadah that I keep circling back to in getting new Haggadahs, I really enjoy the Rabbi Sachs Haggadah, but I keep circling back to the Rabbi Hirsch Haggadah. I don't know if it's translated into English either, but I know that I bought it during my year in Israel, and I am actually coming back to it this year to learn for myself, because for me personally as an educator, I love the way that Rabbi Hirsch thought, Rabbi Shimshon Rafael Hirsch thought about Jews and Judaism and Jewish communities and Jewish rituals, and he is constantly the commentator on Chumash that I go back to every single time, and so I appreciate the deep insights on the Seder. And then I love the Maxwell House Haggadahs and the old school Haggadahs that my family has from the time that my parents were little. We always bring those out. There's one Haggadah, it's not the Maxwell House Haggadah, but it's from when my dad was little. They used to use this one, and it has like facts, like quotes by Martin Luther King Jr. in it. And we always like to see what random shtick is in there that you would never think to put in a Haggadah that I have, that I would buy right now, but it's a lot of fun for my parents to be able to share the things that they had when they were little at the Seder. What I'm doing now, so similarly, I don't even know where I'm going to be living 100% at the night of the Seder, so there's a lot going on for everybody, and to that degree, I would say that it's important to remember that even though there were so amazing ideas that were shared tonight, and I hope this is being recorded so that I can re-listen and go back to it, because I want to listen again and again and again to all of the insights that were shared by Rabbi Ehrenfeld and Rabbi Wallach, but you can't do everything every year. Like, that's what I was saying before in the timeline of the Seders and the development. Like, one year we did the headdresses thing, and one year everything changes every year, and you can't do everything every year. And if the goal is to have every single section of the Seder be impactful and meaningful and deep, your Seder is going to go till 4 o'clock in the morning, and everyone's going to be asleep anyway. So what I would recommend, and I'm speaking to myself as much as everyone here, is to pick a few things that you're going to do really well and blow it out of the park. And for me personally, I'm a spreadsheet kind of girl. So what I'll do is, when I decide on whatever my priorities are, I'll make a spreadsheet of what I need to get done and what I want to plan and when I want to schedule time to plan what I want to plan, because I know that without that spreadsheet, the same way, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I'm cooking for a big meal, I'm thinking back to when we were on campus, and for Pesach, we were hosting tons and tons of students. Like, I made myself a schedule of what I was going to do every single day for 2 weeks leading up to it. And my mom jokes all the time because people prepare for Thanksgiving like this, because they, like, it's the one time a year that they cook a ton. But I think that our entire Pesach prep should kind of look like that. I mean, with Purim, there's this notion that whatever you're spending on all of the mitzvot of Purim, you should spend all of that combined and then some on Matanos La'Avyonim, because that's the essence of the day. And I think that in terms of our energy allotment, we should think about the Seder in the same way, that whatever I'm spending emotionally and energetically and time-wise on the cleaning and the shopping and the food and the clothes and all that, which are very important, we should also be willing and excited to spend that. I mean, you all showed up to a night about how to make your Seder engaging, so I don't have to tell you, you're already here for it. You're excited about it. So to figure out the way to budget your time and your energy so that you have exactly the same amount of energy that you give to making your table look beautiful and to making your food delicious, and none of that should suffer, but to be able to be planful so that at the end of the day you have beautiful food, and hopefully other people in your house, not just you, are helping out with that. You have beautiful food in your house, you have a beautiful table set, you have whatever props you want. We always buy marshmallows to throw at each other for hail, so you have marshmallows if you use that. Rabbi Brands actually shared with us his Seder dollars. I don't know if he shared that with anybody else here, but one year he was telling us about ways he makes his Seder engaging, and he has Seder dollars that he gives out for people that ask good questions, and we actually use them with adults, and it's a lot of fun. But like, print out your Seder dollars, make your props, whatever it is, and make sure that you're giving yourself the beautiful gift of the time that you need in order to prepare for the Seder to make it special. Because especially if it's going to be your family and small and different this year, just like it was last year, you deserve that for yourself to feel like your Seder was really special. So I really hope that we all are able to get to our Seder and be really proud of what we've built with our families.
Wow, thank you so much. First, on the recording note, my computer is having some technical difficulties, so